You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, May 7th, 2009, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
And happy, right, National Day of Prayer and National Day of Reason.
Are they actually on the same day?
They are.
What a coincidence.
That had to be done deliberately.
But, you know, awesome. So I prayed for more reason, and it worked. I stopped praying. So, hey.
That was good.
Who knew it would work out that way? But it did.
So Rebecca cannot join us this evening.
I wonder why.
This is actually this is the only reason why it's okay for Rebecca to miss our 4-year anniversary.
Because our esteemed colleague, Rebecca Watson, who often refers to us as, oh, things like Uber geeks, nerds, you know, anything having to do with geekdom, we apparently define that. She is, this Thursday night, out seeing an early screening of the new Star Trek movie. Well, the rest of us are here slaving away on this podcast.
That's right.
And she didn't invite us.
Right, which is the worst thing is that she didn't invite the rest of us.
Well, that's true.
That's right.
True.
We're all going to see it tomorrow night.
That's right. Like the rest of the normal geeks.
Right.
I am totally psyched to see this.
So, Rebecca, I don't want to hear about utility belts ever again or anything like that. You are now the queen of geekdom.
And that's right.
It's official.
She's the queen of the nerds.
Here's your crown, your majesty.
But this is our 4-year anniversary.
Yeah.
Four years of the SGU.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
It only seems like 1,459 days.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Well, I have to tell you guys, I'm actually pretty surprised that we made it 4 years, that the Skeptic's Guide has been here for 4 years. I really am I'm thrilled that people listen to the show and that they like it, but I just didn't think that it would ever go this long.
How come?
I don't know. I mean, it isn't really, honestly, I don't think that we've hit our 4-year mark because we have a lot of people listening. It's much more about like how much we still enjoy doing this and, you know, how dedicated we all are. I mean, if anything, we're more into the whole project now than I think we were, you know, a few months after we started.
We didn't really know what would become of it. We didn't know how it would be received.
Total experiment.
We didn't know what kind of exposure we could potentially get. We thought, you know, a few hundred or maybe 1,000 listeners would be a pretty tremendous accomplishment for us.
I honestly had no idea. I had no idea how many listeners we would get. I didn't know how many listeners podcasts got at the time. It took a while for us to figure out, you know, what the podcasting universe was like.
And it's a changing target.
Yeah, it's been a moving target, yeah. But actually, in 2 weeks, we're having our 200th episode. 200.
Yes.
And hopefully 200. Rebecca will be able to join us for that episode. So
we've made 121 more episodes than the original Star Trek series.
Oh, wow, Jay.
But we haven't completed our 5-year mission yet.
Good one, Steve.
Yeah, so we'll reminisce a little bit more in 2 weeks. But for now, let's go on with some news. Have you guys heard about Oprah Winfrey's latest abomination?
Of course.
It's pretty scary and upsetting and annoying. I think it's a sign of the apocalypse.
It's one of the signs of the apocalypse. That's correct. So Oprah Winfrey has signed Jenny McCarthy to a multi-venue, multi-year contract. She's essentially going to give her her own show. Her own television.
Stand-up comedy? Is she going to juggle? Is she going to...
Pick her nose.
And entertain... Right.
Eat her own boogers?
Pose nude? All these things that she's has experience at? No.
No, it's going to be a talk show where she talks.
Oh, forget it.
Oh, boy. You know, we talk about the harm that many specific people do, and certainly Jenna McCarthy has been up there recently with her anti-vaccinationist misinformation. You know, she seems to be dedicated to bringing back preventable childhood illnesses, and she even says that she's okay with that. If, you know, kids have to die so that she, you know, she can spread her misinformation, that's just okay. But Oprah Winfrey is the person who facilitates and promotes and spreads all of these, you know, various woo masters and people spreading misinformation. So she's the queen of the woo.
More of like a godmother in the sense of a godfather, like of a crime organization, right? I mean, that's kind of how I see her. She's, you know, what can
she's
I
the godmother of a misinformation syndicate?
I think so. I mean, right? She's got her fingers in a whole bunch of, like, dirty pies that way.
Also, there's really no way to combat what she does. You can't fight back at the same, like, level that she's misspreading the, you know, she's spreading this misinformation. And there isn't anybody in the press today or in the media that is, you know, spreading correct information at that level.
And she's her own media organization. She has television, she has magazine, she's got, you know, the book angle of everything. Mm-hmm. She really is her own. It's Harpo Productions. It's a mass media company.
Right.
That is what she is.
Yeah, it's terrible. There is so much money, for whatever reason, there is so much money in the anti-vaccination movement. They are incredibly well-funded. And now Jim Carrey and Oprah Winfrey and Jenny McCarthy are lending a tremendous amount of further resources and celebrity to it. It's unfortunate. You know, it's just, it's the whole thing is upside down.
Media mogul on our side of the fight.
We need somebody with money who's not a gullible ass.
Trying.
The most pessimistic predictions are that the anti-vaccination movement is going to get to the point where there is a serious return of childhood diseases. You know, and then only when
yes.
when people are reminded about how deadly these diseases are, will there be a public clamor for, you know, vaccines to protect their children. But, you know, only after a tremendous amount of harm has been done.
And death, that's right.
But we'll continue to do what we can. There has been some interesting news items concerning whether or not dark matter really exists. Bob, tell us about that.
Yeah, dark matter's really been taking it on the chin lately. And some scientists are looking for a knockout punch, it seems. Last November, a particle detector on a high-altitude balloon detected an intriguing increase in high-energy particles that could potentially have come from dark matter particles that somehow collided and created these high-energy particles that we could detect, because we can't really detect the dark matter particles. And so the scientists were really excited. They figured, oh, wow, we're really going to get a bead now on the nature of dark matter, because if you can really narrow down the range of this detectable energy, then you might be able to infer information about the dark matter that would be needed to create it. But then on May 2nd, NASA reported that their orbiting Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope has not seen the energy spikes that were reported in November. Now, this doesn't disprove dark matter, of course, but it still was very disappointing, and they're still trying to figure out what's going on here. But then, now most recently, two new studies were released by researchers in Germany, Austria, and Australia. And they're using these studies to support the notion that dark matter might not even exist at all, which was a surprise to me. I haven't been tracking it to this level of detail, and it was a little surprising to me that they were trying to actually say that it's just not there, that, you know, the emperor is not wearing any clothes. To do this, though, it would require an update, actually, to Newton's theory of gravity, which sounds pretty drastic to me. We should probably just go over dark matter real quick.
Yeah, give the quick background.
It's a form of matter that's hypothesized to explain some anomalies, including why galaxies don't fly apart. For decades now, scientists have known that galaxies rotate far too fast, and they should be throwing out stars like kids flying off those playground spinny things.
Yeah.
What do you call those? carousels, right?
Yeah, carousels.
But this doesn't happen. The stars stay put. So scientists hypothesize that the galaxy must somehow be embedded in this halo of hidden matter that only interacts with normal matter gravitationally and cannot, so far, be detected in any other way.
So, Bob, are you saying that other matter, the dark matter, is kind of like packed in around everything else and it holds it in place, or the gravity?
Yeah, so just to put it another way, you can use the gravitational equations of Newton and even, you know, general relativity to say that, like, the our sun is traveling around the center of the galaxy at a certain speed. You can calculate how much mass there would need to be within the orbit of our sun to keep it, you know, rotating at that speed, right? Because the more mass there is, the more gravity there is, the faster you go. So if you calculate how much mass there should be within the orbit of our star around the galaxy, that comes out to be a lot more mass than what we can see. There's not enough visible matter to account for all of the mass that should be within the galaxy. Therefore, there must be some dark matter, matter that we cannot see, to account for the missing mass and the gravity that has to be there.
But it's been 30 years now, and we're still really not that much closer to finding out what the hell dark matter is. It's really frustrating because it's been so long. Scientists, especially those in Europe, have become increasingly skeptical of even the existence of dark matter now. And this includes these scientists from the University of Vienna and the Australian National University who've been looking at satellite galaxies to our own Milky Way. Now, satellite galaxies are dwarf galaxies, tiny, maybe, you know, from 1,000 stars on up, very small. Our best theories are saying that they should surround major galaxies by the hundreds. But one anomaly we have, though, is that if you look around the Milky Way, we're only seeing 30 of them instead of, say, 200 or so. Now, that's not too much of an anomaly because you could say that, well, they're probably so dim that you can't resolve them. You just can't see these guys because they're so small. But there's other anomalies that are pretty odd, though, with these satellite galaxies. Most of them are not randomly distributed. You would think there would be a random distribution of these satellite galaxies around the Milky Way, but the ones that we detect are generally in a plane. And not only that, they rotate in the same direction as we do. This is like the planets in our solar system, most of them anyway. But this all makes sense. As weird as that is, it kind of makes sense if you look at these dwarf galaxies as if they were fragments left over from our old collisions of young galaxies, that collided with ours many eons ago. That all kind of makes sense. They would be in a plane, they would be rotating the same way as us, but there's a catch, though, to this theory. The theoretical calculations say that dark matter should not exist in these dwarf galaxies. The astronomers checked this out, of course, and they looked at the rotation of these dwarf galaxies, and what did they find? Well, they found that the rotation is too fast for the observable matter. So maybe there's dark matter in these guys too, and it just really wasn't making sense. Satellite researcher Manuel Metz says that if classical physics holds, this can only be attributed to the presence of dark matter. But what's the other side to that coin? The other side is that classical physics is wrong, and this is where it really starts to get interesting. Fellow researcher Dr. Pavel Grupa says that the only solution would be to reject Newton's classical theory of gravitation. We probably live in a non-Newton universe. If this is true, then our observations could be explained without dark matter. Pretty interesting statement. So in context, this isn't as weird as it sounds. Updating Newton is not new. Look at the last 100 years. Special relativity updated Newton's gravity for high-velocity situations. General relativity made some revisions. When objects are in close proximity to something incredibly massive, quantum mechanics did the same for objects at subatomic scales. So there is some precedence for this. We have updated Newton. You know, it's not sacrosanct. We have made changes to it. So another change, you know, maybe it doesn't sound that radical when you consider that. So what kind of change are we talking about here? It's called Modified Newtonian Dynamics Theory, or MOND, M-O-N-D, was proposed by Israeli physicist Mordechai Milgram in 81, and the idea is that acceleration is not linearly proportional to force at low values. Now, this means that they would need to change this one equation, not just this only one, but this is an important one. F equals ma. Maybe you guys heard of that one. Force equals mass times acceleration.
Oh, sure.
The net force on an object is equal to the mass of the object multiplied by its acceleration. They'd have to make a little tweak to that. This is Newton's second law of motion. You might think that we verified this damn thing to the 100th decimal place, right? It's been around for so long, and you think we'd have it nailed. And we have verified it very well, but only for large gravitational accelerations, not for the really tiny ones. And this is exactly what we find at the scale of galaxies. Stellar distances are so great that gravity can induce only tiny accelerations. So that A, the A in F equals ma, has not really been verified for for extremely tiny values like you would find at the scale of galaxies. So maybe, you know, maybe it doesn't hold up precisely as F equals MA implies, and you might need to make this little change to the equation, which would basically just throw a function in between the M and the A that changes depending on, you know, how big or small A is. And that could explain the gravitational situation we're seeing out there with the galaxies, and it might obviate the need for dark matter to even exist.
But Bob, it's been my understanding up to this point, and I think we've even asked a couple of people about this, that there are some lines of evidence for dark matter that rule out the alternate explanation that we just need to alter our equations for gravity.
Absolutely. I was going to bring them up. There are some ways that that dark matter helps with the Big Bang, the theory of the Big Bang, and the structure of the universe. And that's one of the problems I have with this is, well, okay, this sounds good, unless you really consider these other ways that dark matter has been key in our theoretical formulation. So I don't know how they're going to get around that. I don't think it doesn't seem like you can just do away with dark matter in one fell swoop. There might be other things that they might need to do.
Right.
But it is interesting that they're really pushing for this, and who knows what might come of it, but they'll have to deal with some of these other issues where dark matter really seems to be required.
Yeah, so we're not giving up on dark matter just yet.
No, absolutely not.
And obviously there's going to need to be more observations to try to sort out which one of these two approaches is more feasible, more helpful, you know, better able to explain what we observe. Either altering gravitational equations or the existence of a type of matter to explain the missing gravity. Are you guys familiar with the concept of 6 degrees of separation?
Oh, yeah.
I think so, yeah.
This is the notion that any two people in the world can be connected on average by just 6 degrees of separation. So you can make a chain, like person A to person B to person C, to connect any two people in the world. This idea was initially put forward by Stanley Milgram, the psychology researcher. Essentially, he tried to see like how many people would you have to pass a letter between to get a letter from person A to person B. That concept of this 6 degrees of separation got into the popular consciousness, and it's been there ever since. It was also given more popularity by the movie of that name with Will Smith. You guys see that movie?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's when I realized that he was a really good actor.
Yeah, not just some rap artist. Right.
And don't forget the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, which I think really embedded it in popular culture.
Which is a
twist on the whole notion. That is, you can connect Kevin Bacon to any other actor or Hollywood actor through 6 or fewer movies, right, in which...
That he starred with
someone.
Yeah,
so like
right.
You might see Kevin Bacon starred with actor A in this movie, and actor A starred with actor B in this other movie, and then you do that until you get to the actor that you're trying to connect Kevin Bacon to.
It could be anybody.
Same.
Right?
And it's partly a joke that, you know, Kevin Bacon's been in so many different movies with so many different people that you can do this. Well, it turns out there really isn't that much evidence that the 6 degrees of separation concept is true. It's actually based on fairly thin evidence. Not that it's wrong, it's just that it hasn't really been confirmed to a high degree. But recently there are those who have been essentially developing a new science out of this concept, a science of connections, you know, of using like mathematical models to try to figure out how networks form and how individuals within the network relate to each other. This would be useful, for example, in trying to figure out how communicable diseases spread, right? It's like you might think of the 6 degrees of separation concept in as you're only, you know, 6 handshakes away from any germ on the planet, right? So you could think about it that way. Recently, there was an attempt to some degree to replicate the Milgram experiment. This was done by a BBC program. What they did is they took 40 parcels given to people randomly picked around the world, and then they had to find a way to get the parcel to a specific person. all to the same person, a guy by the name of Mr. Vidal. Of the 40 parcels, only three made it to the destination.
Wait, only three made it in less than six steps, or only three ever made it?
Only three made it at all. The other three, the other 37, never found their way to Mr. Vidal. Of those three that made it, on average, it took six steps to get there. So the 6 degrees held up for those three out of the 30, out of the 40. The question is, why did the 37 not make it? How were the chains broken? Were they broken because of just laziness, or just, you know, failing to put enough effort into it? I mean, it's hard to imagine that there was no pathway. I mean, I think it'd be hard to imagine that you couldn't find any pathway from one individual to another. It's just a matter of how many connections you'd have to make. So essentially, they just gave up before the parcel got to its destination. But we don't know. Was that because the chains were too long? You know, maybe only the shortest chains were the ones that made it. So again, yes, those, you know, three parcels made it in six steps, but that doesn't mean that you can connect any two people in the world by six or fewer steps. The more interesting thing about this is the science of networks that is developing out of this basic concept, and trying to develop the math that would be necessary in order to calculate, on average, how many people would you have to go through in order to connect any two people in the world. Then this may apply in some ways that might not initially appear obvious. For example, some of the researchers are thinking about how cells interact in the body, or in how, like, they might exchange proteins. And they said that's really exactly the same kind of, that's a 6 degrees of separation problem. Which cells are connected to which other cells, and how would they, you know, pass information or substances or proteins between them? So even there may be biological applications, as well as, you know, as communicable diseases, as well as networks within an industry. You know, there's any time where there's a network of stuff moving around, this mathematics could potentially apply to it.
And things like that, they're so easy to believe because they seem to have like an inherent rightness about them, you know, like, oh yeah, I know my brother Steve, and he knows every doctor at Yale, and every one of those doctors at Yale, you know, possibly went to medical school and all these different places. And you could start doing the math on that too, and that's how I kind of came to the conclusion that I believed in the 6 degrees of separation. But
it's not unreasonable, and again, it may in fact be true, more or less. It's just that it has more of an urban myth status right now than hard science.
Yeah, it's not a paranormal claim or anything like that. It's certainly plausible.
And also, if you think about, you know, actually, the whole notion of memes also, it kind of is a network problem. How do ideas spread, like the 6 degrees of separation itself? You know, how do these ideas spread from within the social networks that we form? The things that spread and believe are beliefs that resonate with us in some way. As you say, Jay, it makes a certain inherent sense, or it carries a moral lesson that we like, that resonates with us. So those are the ideas that get passed on. It's the same thing about, like, YouTube. Why do some YouTube videos go viral? What makes something go viral and something else, and, you know, and hundreds of other things not go viral? No one really has the magic formula. No one can really predict. Mm-hmm. Well, let's move on. We have our latest installment in the ongoing series in How Pseudoscience Kills.
Sure does.
It's a very sad story. This one, again, has been sent to us by about a million of our listeners.
Yeah.
A lot of our listeners in Australia. From New South Wales, a homeopath, Thomas Sam, and his wife had a daughter, Gloria, who was born perfectly healthy, but developed a severe skin condition called eczema, which is a very severe rash, that's caused her skin to become dry and to crack and to become very thin. Now, her parents chose to treat her with homeopathy rather than conventional medicine. Their daughter's pediatrician referred them to a skin specialist, a dermatologist, but they refused to take her. And over the next couple of months, they presided over her slowly becoming sick, losing weight, failing to thrive, until she died
From eczema?
Really a horrible death. Well, she became infected and then septic because her skin was all broken down from the eczema. So the skin is your first line of defense against infection.
Yeah, sure is. And what a horrible, awful they described as just a horrific
death. Yeah, can you imagine?
For this little baby.
How old was the child?
9 months. 9 months. And this actually happened back in 2001. She was born in July 2001. She died May 2002. And the trial is only going on now. And it also says in the article here that it's a Supreme Court hearing. So I wonder if this is at any point go through any lower courts.
Yes, it must have. You don't just go straight to the Supreme Court. The reports are that this poor girl spent the last 5 months of her life crying, irritable, scratching, essentially in misery. And throughout this whole time, they refused to give her conventional therapy. They consulted with homeopaths and naturopaths.
And the father himself is a homeopath.
Yeah, he is a homeopath.
So when's the drawing and quartering?
Yeah, it's terrible. I mean, this is, again, an example of how, you know, again, how cult-like this ideology can get. I mean, so dedicated to the belief system, you know, of homeopathy. Again, and this goes beyond just the notion of homeopathy itself, which is, you know, this 200-year-old pre-scientific, you know, healing notion that involves diluting substances beyond the point where there's anything left. So it's essentially water and sugar pills, you know. No possible effect, but it has its adherents, its, you know, true believers. And more recently, you know, these specific modalities like homeopathy are part of a larger ideology, which is very anti-science, anti-conventional medicine, anti-mainstream medicine. It really is almost a religion, you know, it's a belief system. And this, I think, is a very real example of how extreme and overwhelming those beliefs can be. I mean, just imagine watching your child slowly die.
Well, just like an otherwise rational person might get very desperate after conventional medicine has failed and try the more alternative wacky crap, why wouldn't these people at some point when she's getting close to the end say, well, we've tried everything that homeopathy has to offer. Let's try anything, including, you know, modern medicine. Why didn't they ever even reach that point?
Well, Bob, how about the guy that was treating his gangrenous foot with honey?
Yeah, right.
I mean, yeah, it could have saved him up to hours before he died. I mean, the convictions are so strong, so deeply, you know, rooted that sometimes people die because
I imagine that they dug themselves into a psychological hole where bringing the daughter to a doctor would have been an admission of failure, an admission that their ideology was somehow flawed, and they just couldn't bring themselves to do it.
Yeah, they're doing it now?
Steve, here's part, and listen to this part of the article. Actually, a couple articles on this. So at one point, this family traveled to India, all the while, you know, this baby is in the meantime, you know, dying of her infections and so forth. And Manju Sam, the wife, during this trip, developed gallstones. Did they treat her with homeopathic remedies? Nope. She went to the conventional hospital and got treatment.
Oh. Well, yeah. It also could be that she was in an enormous amount of pain because gallstones are incredibly painful.
Can be, yeah.
And, you know, I can see that happening. We don't have any evidence of that, but that makes a lot of sense.
That was my thought, too, yeah. Well, you're in a lot of pain. That changes things for you very quickly.
You know, and this is where questions like, should the states pass laws that, you know, would control this type of thing?
Well, that's the case, is that this is a gross negligence, criminal negligence.
Yeah.
Manslaughter by gross criminal negligence is the actual charge. Well, let's do one quick email before we go on to our interview. This one comes from Jim Mears, and he writes briefly, he has birds in his pants. Perry would have jumped all over this. Airport inspection reveals smuggled songbirds. And then he provides a link. Again. You guys seen the picture of this?
Yeah. Incredible, right?
Picture, yeah. No. So this guy tried to smuggle 14 live birds strapped to his legs. If you look at it, like he has almost knee-high socks on. They're looking wrapped around his calves. And then
I have monkeys in my pants.
Thank you, Perry.
Each bird is in its own little like cocoon. I think their beaks are tied shut. That's probably why they weren't chirping the whole way. However,
or biting
The guy was busted because the airport security noticed that he had feathers and bird poop on his shoes.
Dog poop on his shoes. Really?
Sir, you're molting. And
he was returning from a trip to Vietnam. Was found by Customs and Border Protection agents because of the bird poop on his shoes. And he had, again, 14 birds. Apparently, he bought them for $50 each in Vietnam, and he could have resold them for $300 to $400 a piece in the States. Not bad. Not a bad profit. The birds included three red-whiskered bulbuls, and these are listed as an injurious species under federal law, meaning that they could become an invasive species and cause a lot of harm. Yep. Oops. He also had four magpie robins and six shama thrush.
4 and 20 blackbird stuff in my pants.
Steve, did the article say that they all survived?
It looks like they did.
Even those ones that, you know, were a detriment to the
It looks like
the
they did.
You know,
they get loose. You're free now. Go.
There's something, you know, definitely horrific about this, the way that the animals were treated. And I'm a huge animal lover, and it bothers me greatly. Oh, yeah. But there is also something very funny about this guy sitting on a plane with birds all up and down his pants.
Squirming around.
Well, yeah, and what about the noise or even the smell? Or do you think somebody might have been tipped off at some point before he reached the point of security?
Yeah, you wonder. Did the person sitting next to him, like, see his pants squirming, you know, and flapping? I mean, come on. But it's also, there's a huge problem with invasive species. You know, one of the unintended consequences of globalization is that we're moving animals from one place in the world to another. And, you know, if they are able to establish themselves in a region where they don't have natural enemies
Or Steve, how about that shipwreck down on the coast of Connecticut many years ago, released all those parrots, and now parrots are part
of the
environment of Connecticut.
The parrots of Bridgeport.
Yeah.
Go down to Bridgeport, and there could be a 100 of them nesting in the tree, chirping away, all these green parrots. It's true. So the bottom line is, don't smuggle birds or any other animals into other countries. Well, let's go on with our interview. Joining us now is Dr. Rachel Dunlop. Rachel, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Rachie, as she likes to be known, is a member of the Australian Skeptics. She has a regular segment on The Skeptic Zone, which is the podcast for the Australia for Science and Reason, I guess is your official name. And you are a research scientist, correct? Not a medical doctor.
That's correct, Steve, yes. So the doctor stands for PhD.
And what's your PhD in specifically?
It's in cell biology and physiology and sort of protein oxidation and, that sort of stuff.
And what's your research focus on?
My research focus is aging disorders, actually. So I look at heart disease specifically, but also Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and also diseases that relate to protein disorders. So anything where you get chunks of proteins that build up and interfere with the function of cells. So that would include Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and sort of atherosclerotic plaque that you get in heart disease.
Right. The kind of stuff that gets to all of us eventually.
Yeah, that's right. So with respect to heart disease, that's, you know, how you get buildups of proteins and fats in your arteries, and that results in plaque. And then you can either get occlusion of the artery, which is the blockage, or parts of that plaque breaking off and going through the bloodstream and then causing stroke. So my research is actually looking at the basic science part of that. I'm looking at the turnover and the breakdown of these proteins.
So we're going to be talking to you in a moment about the anti-vaccination movement in Australia. But just first, can you tell us how you got involved with the skeptical movement?
Yeah, it's Richard Saunders' fault, in fact.
Yeah, it's always his fault.
It is, isn't it? I just turned up to Skeptics in the Pub just over a year ago, about a year and a half ago. And I met Richard there, and we just got talking about sort of alternative medicine and supplements and all that kind of stuff. And I just went in head first, I guess. I started to do a bit of research on that sort of thing. And I guess I'd always been interested in it, but I'd never really treated it seriously. So I'd never really looked into how these things work or what their claims were and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, then Richard sort of got me involved in the podcast, which is about 6 months old now, I think, The Skeptic Zone. And it was his idea to do a segment called Dr. Rachie Reports. So that's what I now do once a fortnight. I'm also on the committee of the Australian Skeptics. And, yeah, I do a lot of work in researching alternative medicine claims and investigating them as well as I can and blogging about them if I find that there's something wrong on the internet, as they say.
Mm-hmm. Right. Somebody on the internet is wrong.
Yeah, that's right. I can't come to bed.
Yeah, that's a full-time job. So tell us, because you know, we're interested in what are the similarities and differences in the different types of pseudosciences around the world. So what are the most common alternative medicine scams that are going on in Australia these days?
Well, there's a lot of sort of detox stuff, detox diets and colonic irrigation. And in fact, we have television shows here that look at making people younger in a short amount of time by giving them colonic irrigations and putting them on detox diets and, you know, the lemon detox diet, which I think has done the rounds of the States pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
That's still quite popular here. We seemingly have a big problem with ear candles here.
Yeah, ear candling.
Oh,
it's
wow.
It's kind of a small thing here, but it sounds like it's...
I thought that was extinct.
Yeah, well, no, Bob, it's not. It's alive and well in Australia. And in fact, the Australian Skeptics wrote an open letter to Australian pharmacists last month, published in our Skeptic magazine, imploring them to stop selling quackery. And one of the things that we focused on was ear candles.
Right.
If you go into a pharmacy or a drugstore in Australia, alongside the science-based medicine, and evidence-based medicine, rather, I know you prefer to say that, Steve.
I prefer science-based medicine, right? Just to be clear.
Oh, sorry, I thought you preferred evidence-based medicine.
No, I'm the guy who invented the term science-based medicine.
Oh, okay. Ooh, I apologize.
That's okay. I know, but I'm still trying to, I keep getting the question, what's the difference, actually, between science-based medicine and evidence-based medicine? But that's a separate talk. Go on.
How do ear candles work? Could you describe to the audience what the deal is with that?
Well, I can describe the claims, Bob. They don't actually work, but what they claim to do is they are a piece of paraffin that gets coated in wax and then wrapped around while it's still warm into a sort of tube, a hollow tube. And then you put that into your ear and you light the end of it. And as it burns down, the claims are that it creates a vacuum within your ear canal. And then that can remove things like, well, first of all, earwax, but secondly, things like fungus, parasites, bacteria, to all sorts of things as they align your chakras and can get rid of negative energy.
Did they actually say it causes a vacuum?
Yes, that's right. They do make that claim, but scientific papers have been done which show that there is no vacuum created. And a couple of papers, I think was from 1993, took the candles and put them over a vacuum measuring device and showed that there was no change in pressure. But the claim that these people use for them working is that once you've burnt the candle down, you find deposits of wax in the bottom of the candle near your ear. And they say that that is earwax that has been removed from your ear. But if you take that wax and you do analysis on it, you'll find that it's nothing more than wax from the candle.
Yeah, that always struck me as one of the stupidest claims I've ever heard, that if you stick a candle in your ear and burn it, you'll find wax. It doesn't get much dumber than that.
Well, it doesn't get much dumber than sticking burning sticks in your ears, in my opinion.
Right.
My mum always told me not to put anything smaller in my ear than my elbow. So how you can go extrapolate from that to a burning stick, I don't know. But these things have been debunked over and over again, and in fact, they're banned from sale in Canada. Health Canada banned them from sale a number of years ago, but I found out recently from a friend who is a pharmacist in Canada that they are still for sale there. That's when you kind of can use the phrase, the stupid it burns, literally in that case.
Yeah, stupid it burns.
But the thing is, they are actually really dangerous, and there have been cases of people losing their hearing temporarily, having to have surgery because hot wax has dripped inside their eardrums. There was an incident in Alaska where a woman actually died, not as a direct result of the candle, but she was candling on her bed without supervision, and she set fire to her bedding.
Mm-hmm.
And she managed to escape the house, which subsequently burnt down, but she had an asthma attack in hospital and died. You know, they have a lot of risks, and so they have been banned in Canada. But in Australia, you can walk into your pharmacy and next to the antibiotics and the painkillers, you can buy these things and stick them in your ears. We've been on a bit of a campaign to implore pharmacists in this country to have a look at their business and be aware of the fact that they are respected and trusted in the community, and that this kind of alternative woo is really not what we would expect from these people.
So you're trying to shame them into doing the right thing, essentially.
Essentially, yes. And so we wrote this open letter that I mentioned. Of course, ear candles aren't the only problems in pharmacies in Australia. There's also homeopathy, which I won't even begin to talk about.
Yeah.
And bark flower remedies and detox diets and all that kind of stuff. But because there is evidence to show these things do cause harm, we've targeted these.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say we've had a really good response, actually. We had the president of the New South Wales Pharmacy Association saw our letter, and he commented on it, and he wrote an editorial response in an online pharmacy journal called I2P, which is Information to Pharmacists, looking at their code of conduct and pointing out to these people that, in fact, this is not the sort of thing they should be doing according to their code of conduct, and called on them to take on board what we had said, and that if they are issues like this in their business, and they should redress what they are doing. They did get a bit of a slap on the wrist, but it's not legislation. It's sort of voluntary. So
Right. We
understand that pharmacists are businesses, you know, they need to make a profit. We don't have any issues with that, but we're just asking them to perhaps eliminate some of these really quackery, dangerous products out of their pharmacies.
Yeah. I mean, you're right, but it's also a profession, which comes with it a certain ethical responsibility, which it seems to me they're violating by selling dangerous quackery to the public under their professional imprimatur.
Well, that's the point we were trying to make to them.
Yeah.
You know, I've spoken to a couple of them just sort of going in as posing as a layman, and they've said, oh, yeah, look, I wouldn't recommend them to my customers, but they sell really well, so what can you do?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
And then I've had some of them look at me blankly and go, what do you mean? What's wrong with them?
Yeah, yeah. So tell us about the anti-vaccination movement in Australia.
Yeah, I recently came across them because I was doing a report for Dr. Rachey on figures that were released by our government in 2008, November, which was about the status of immunisation in this country. In fact, on the scheme of it, it looks like we're doing pretty well on the face of it, sorry. I think overall in this country, there's something like an average coverage of about 90 to 95% of people are vaccinated, or kids rather. I mean, obviously it varies on the age group because, you know, you start getting vaccinated from birth and up to about 6 years old. So across that spectrum, there are waves and troughs. But if you look at the average across the country, it's around 90%, which seems pretty good.
That's pretty good. United States is around 95%. Great Britain is a little bit less. Their MMR, I think, is down to about 80%.
Wow.
So that's, yeah, 90% is right on the border there, right on the edge of herd immunity.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when you look closer at the figures, you'll see that there are pockets, obviously, like there are anywhere in the country where that is a lot less. One of those places is in Western Australia. I think it's in Albany, where it's about 85 or 80%. And then you look over at New South Wales, and on the northern coast of New South Wales, the coverage is only 66% for certain age groups and for certain vaccines. And so I started looking into why this might be the case, and I came across this group known as the Australian Vaccination Network. Now, they call themselves the Australian Vaccination Network, Steve, so you might think that sounds like, oh, well, they're obviously maybe positive or pro, but really that's just a misnomer for the anti-vax lobby.
Mm-hmm.
And they are very active on the north coast of New South Wales, where their national president, as she calls herself, Meryl Dorey, is based. They have a campaign of going to mothers' groups and going to sort of pregnancy groups and giving lectures about how vaccines are bad and how they cause all manner of diseases and, you know, they exacerbate the problem rather than help the problem, all the kind of scare tactics that you guys are used to and I guess everyone's used to.
Yeah.
But the reason why we've started to go on the attack on them recently is in this particular part of New South Wales 6 weeks ago, and in fact, currently in New South Wales, we are experiencing a whooping cough epidemic. Queensland is also experiencing a measles epidemic. Part of the reason for that whooping cough epidemic in New South Wales is that the coverage for vaccination for pertussis or whooping cough is down to 66%, as I said. Another part of the problem, and I'll probably go into this in more detail later, is that adults who should get booster shots and haven't been notified or are not aware that they should, the coverage on adults is only about 10%. So there's been this epidemic, and the result of that was the tragic death of a four-week-old baby about 6 weeks ago, Dana McCaffrey. She was 4 weeks old, as I mentioned, so she's too young to receive vaccination for pertussis. The schedule in Australia is that your first immunisation for that is at 6 weeks old. So she was in the area where she couldn't get vaccinated, but she was living in an area where the herd immunity was lost.
Mm-hmm.
She was succumbed to whooping cough, and she went to intensive care, and tragically she died.
So, young infants depend upon herd immunity. So there are some people who cannot get vaccinated. They're too young, or they have some chronic illness that means they cannot be vaccinated. So those are the ones that are made vulnerable, especially by the loss of herd immunity.
That's right, yeah. And this was the tragedy of this case.
And then Channel 7 in Australia did a television show on that case, on the case of Dana McCaffrey.
Yeah, basically, Channel 7 has a show called Sunday Night, and they picked up on the story and they did an investigation about the death of Dana, sort of in the context of the loss of herd immunity on the northern coast of New South Wales. And we heard that this was going to be on TV, and we are used to in Australia, and I guess most people that listen to your show are used to the mainstream media not being particularly responsible in terms of reporting science accurately. Ben Goldacre talks about this, and it's a big problem in one way, because journalists are often concerned about getting both sides of the story, but sometimes if one side of the story is so skewed to the fringe and to the extreme, if you take both sides and then cut down the middle, you still get an extreme viewpoint, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, it's called a false balance approach.
That's right, yeah. So I guess that could have been what the outcome if we had heard a lot of stuff from the anti-vax people. The producer on the story, Rebecca Latorno, spoke to both sides, and she reported the situation on the northern coast, but she reported it with a science base and with evidence and in a responsible manner, basically covering and showing people what are the outcomes of not vaccinating your children, how that affects not only your children but other people's children, and speaking to the paediatrician who tried to save Dana, Dr. Peter Engel, speaking to another doctor who works at the University of Sydney, Professor Peter McIntyre, about the importance of vaccinating, and overall presented a very well-researched and scientifically-based television program about the importance of vaccination.
Yeah, Americans can see it on YouTube. I viewed it. It was pretty good. You know, certainly for a mainstream media piece, I thought it was pretty good. They still gave the anti-vaxxers an opportunity to say their piece. I'm not sure it was optimally countered, you know, on the show. But again, I agree with you that it was a pretty good piece.
What was their argument, though? How could they counter the facts? What was their defense?
Yeah, the defense, Bob, was that Meryl Dorey, who is the national president for the anti-vax lobby, when talking about whooping cough, said that you didn't die from it 30 years ago and you won't die from it now.
That was basically it, yeah.
Yeah. She was basically saying that when she was a child, her mother would put her out with the other sick kids so that she could get the disease and then she could build up natural immunity that way. She also said that her children, she has children who are vaccinated and unvaccinated, and she said they had whooping cough. She treated it homeopathically, and it was only a bad cough, and it lasted for a couple of weeks, so it's not really a big deal. So their argument juxtaposed alongside the hacking cough and this poor baby trying to gasp for air, who subsequently died in intensive care after a double blood transfusion, was that you don't die from this stuff anymore. You just need a healthy lifestyle. You need to eat the right foods, and your mother should shove you in a room with everybody else, because childhood diseases are exactly that. You're meant to get them in your childhood.
And also, it's interesting because typically the news media will find some human interest story around which to build their piece. And often they find the child whose parents believe their autism was caused by a vaccine. You know, they usually present the human interest story is on the fringe or the anti-science side. And it's the scientists who are, you know, saying that the data from scientific experiments, and that's juxtaposed against these real world stories which are telling a different story. So it was interesting to see it work the other way, where they chose to go with a human interest story that was a child who died because of the lack of herd immunity, because of all the nonsense spread by the anti-vaxxers. But they still followed that formula, which I think is a little manipulative and emotional, but just this way it cut towards the direction of science.
But that was part of the problem too, Steve, in the sense that there was a very small part of the program where they spoke to a mother and her teenage son who said that he had been vaccine injured. Now, they didn't go into much detail about that, and so we only saw a very short grab of that story. So we don't really know the full details, but as a result of that, and as a result of the fact that Meryl Dorey only received a very small amount of airtime, the anti-vax lobby went hysterical.
Yes. And you've been in contact with the parents of Dana McCaffrey?
Yes, I have been in contact with the parents. As a result of the Sunday program, the first story that aired, Channel 7 had so much of an overwhelming response from the public. They had both positive and negative. A lot of it came from the anti-vax lobby, and a lot of it was abusive. And they were pressured into doing a forum or a debate, which they did the following Sunday. And this is where they had an anti-vax doctor and then Professor Peter McIntyre, who was a paediatrician, and an audience which consisted of science-based people and the anti-vax people.
So this is on that show, the Sunday night show. They had this a week later, is that it?
That's right, Bob. This was the second part of the show.
It's also available on YouTube, so our audience can watch both of them.
Yeah. If you go to YouTube and look for Richard Saunders' channel, you'll find it. But, yeah, so I actually sat next to David and Tony McCaffrey during that debate, and I have to say, Steve, I was absolutely astounded by the lack of respect and what seemed to me to be a lack of remorse from the anti-vaxxers, really. They didn't seem to have any consideration for the fact that these two people who 6 weeks ago lost their four-week-old daughter to a preventable disease, they didn't seem to have any remorse about that. And they carried on and threw out, you know, misinformation and misinterpretation of scientific research. And, I mean, it got as bad as the fact that I was sitting next to David McCaffrey and we both audibly heard someone from the audience say, well, it was only one baby.
Right.
Oh, wow.
And he leaned into me and said, yes, but it was my baby.
Mm-hmm.
So it came across to me as to them as if I was just another statistic and, you know.
Pretty callous.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's essentially what the anti-vaxxers over here are saying. Like Jenny McCarthy was saying that, yeah, some kids will die from not being vaccinated, but like these are acceptable losses. Right, that's essentially their position. It's absurd. And of course, there was that the British radio host who also essentially said the same thing. That yeah, so kids died of these diseases, you know, but the strong survived. It really is that's the attitude that we encounter. They are the worst kind of extremists. That really is a cult-like atmosphere, and they foster this incredible black and white, us versus them, good and evil view of the world. And the McCaffreys they're on the side of evil, according to the anti-vaxxers, even though they're just innocent victims whose four-week-old child died. It doesn't matter. They're on the side of the pro-vaccination people, so that makes them evil. That's that simple to them.
Yeah, sorry, I've even seen things floating around from them subsequently saying that because there are allegations that they sent hate mail to the McCaffreys after they came out to speak to the media. And that was reported on the show, in fact. The moderator said to them, look, some of the hate mail that these people have been receiving came from your organisation. And I've subsequently heard that they're claiming, well, that's not the sort of thing we would do. That's what the pro-vax people would do. Oh, and by the way, Steve, they're not anti-vax. They're pro-choice, okay?
Yeah. Yeah, they pull the same crap here. Like that one, that pediatrician said, I'm not anti-vaccine, but meanwhile, she hasn't vaccinated a single patient in 18 years. She's pro-choice, but 100% of her patients over the last 18 years have chosen not to be vaccinated. Please. I mean, please.
Richard sat through one of their DVDs yesterday just to see the sort of things that they actually say. And this DVD was from 2002. It was a compilation of lectures that they had been giving. And some of the things that they say, and this is what they're telling their members, by the way. So their members are listening to what they're saying and believing it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a guy by the name of Archie Kalikarinos, who's a physician and speaks on behalf of the AVN. And he was talking about the policy of vaccinating in Africa. And he claims that that's the AIDS problem is a result of that. And he says that the policy was to use dirty needles during vaccination programs, and this was a deliberate policy of genocide, which puts Hitler and Stalin in the shade and makes them look like guardian angels. And he's claiming that the pharmaceutical companies know that they are doing it, they admit the harm, but they continue to do it. That's the kind of nonsense that you hear from them. You'll also, you know, they'll also tell you that meningitis has increased exponentially since the vaccines were introduced. They tell their members that vaccinations suppress the immune system.
Which is wow. The opposite of the truth, yeah.
Well, exactly. There's another guy that says that intravenous vitamin C will neutralize almost any viral infection you like and will neutralize the toxin from meningitis. So apparently you don't need antibiotics or vaccination, just vitamin C. Meryl Dorey has been known to say that sometimes it's not beneficial for children to not have childhood illnesses. You know, they actually need to get them. That's what you, as a childhood illness, that's what it is. You get it as a child, and that's just the way it is.
Right. Well, children do get childhood illnesses. They get tons of colds, and they get exposed to many, many viruses, so the immune system is constantly being stimulated. Getting an extra couple particularly virulent infections is not really beneficial to the immune system overall. That's an absurd claim. Which is interesting because they also say that the vaccines are over-challenging the immune system, but that infections won't over-challenge the immune system. It doesn't make any even basic internal consistency or sense.
Well, one of the things they like to do, Steve, is carry on about, you know, big pharma. Pharmaceutical companies don't care about your health. They're just after your money, all that sort of stuff, which is interesting because a lot of big pharmaceutical companies manufacture, you know, alternative medicine products too, like supplements and vitamins, but they seem to ignore that part.
Yeah.
But one of the things they particularly like to carry on about is how doctors in this country get paid an incentive to complete the vaccination schedule. Now, this was a policy introduced by the government in 1997, and it came at a time when only 53% of children in Australia had completed their schedule. And as you know, if you don't get your entire vax schedule, then you can still be at risk of catching a communicable disease. So they introduced this 7-point plan, and part of this was to introduce a financial incentive to doctors to talk to parents to make sure that they finish all of the shots that kids need. And so that gave them, you know, just a reminder to get the herd immunity back up, because at this time it was as low as 53%.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the anti-vaxxers like to pick up on this, and they like to carry on about how doctors are being bribed to vaccinate kids, and it's a big pharma conspiracy and the government are involved. But also part of this plan was the maternity immunisation allowance, which we have in this country, and this is a payment to parents of $200 Australian if they finish the full schedule of vaccinations. Now, there is an exemption clause with this, Steve, and that exemption clause is that if you decide you do not want to vaccinate your children, you go and see your GP, he or she explains to you the pros and cons of vaccinating versus not, and then you can fill out a form and you can get the $200 anyway. So it's dishonest of the anti-vax lobby in this country to carry on about how doctors get paid when they also are entitled to get paid through this scheme. And they never seem to mention that. And as is the case with many of them, they cherry pick information wherever they like to suit their, you know, agenda. And that's one of the things they do. And I think it's really dishonest and hypocritical of them to accuse doctors of that when they also get paid.
Well, Rachel, thank you so much for giving us the report. from Australia about the anti-vax movement and your other efforts with skepticism and trying to educate the public about alternative medicine. So we appreciate all the good work you're doing down there.
Thanks very much, Steve. And can I just finish off by asking people to join the Facebook page called Stop the AVN? If you just search Stop the AVN for Australian Vaccination Network on Facebook, you'll find it. And there's also a petition linked to that Facebook page, which you can sign, which we're going to be sending to the federal health minister to see if we can get something done about these people, because they're doing so much damage. There needs to be something done about it. It's just getting out of control here.
Absolutely.
Are you sure AVN doesn't stand for Anti-Vaccination Network?
No, it stands for pro-choice, I'm not anti-vaccination network, Bob, or something like that. They're not anti, they're pro-choice. Don't forget that.
And we'll see you in 2010 when we make our trip down to your neck of the woods.
Of course, you guys are coming here. That's fantastic. Yeah, we're very excited. We're very excited.
Can't wait.
Excited to come down.
Cannot wait.
Yeah, the skeptical movement's really building here. We're getting lots and lots of people. People are getting really pissed off, I think. So, yeah, well, there'll be lots of people here when you guys come down, so that'll be great.
Excellent.
I started packing already.
All right, well, take care, Rachel.
Bye.
Thanks very much, Steve. Bye, Bob.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake-a-rama.
We're ready.
Okay. Well, then, here we go. Item number one. Scientists reveal the first car that can run on biofuel made from chocolate. Item number two. Physicists have developed a new incandescent light bulb suitable for residential use that is almost 100 times as energy efficient as existing bulbs. And item number three, a new fossil analysis shows that the so-called hobbit, or Homo floresiensis, had long flat feet more like apes than humans and therefore could not walk efficiently. Evan, please go first.
So apparently we have the first car that can run on biofuel made from chocolate. Well, isn't that fascinating? I'm having a problem with that because, you know, chocolate is something that is a, you know, you need certain ingredients and you put it together and so forth, and then you wind up with chocolate, but then it's a biofuel. Why couldn't it be a biofuel made of its core ingredients before you get to the stage of chocolate? So I'm not quite sure about that one. And then the next one was the new incandescent light bulb suitable for residential use. That's probably key there. 100 times as energy efficient as existing bulbs. I think that's plausible. More plausible than the chocolate one. They're constantly trying, I think, to come up with new inventions for better light bulbs and so forth instead of these, you know, squiggly mercury contained sort of light bulbs that we've all now put in our homes. So I think that's plausible. And then the last one was the so-called hobbit, Homo floresiensis, had long flat feet more like apes than humans and could not walk efficiently. Well, I don't know what to think of that. Long flat feet make you walk less efficiently? I don't know. I've never been to clown college, so I don't think I can quite appreciate that. So I'll stick with what I think is essentially wrong, and that would be the chocolate one, the biofuel made from chocolate. That one is fiction.
Okay, Jay.
You know, the biofuel from chocolate, Steve, that's what the hell you want me to say about that? Sounds ridiculous.
It's delicious.
You know, all right, it's not running on chocolate, right? If this one isn't fiction, it's probably running on something from the chocolate plant, and they do something to it and they turn it, you know how that works. It's not chocolate. You're not sticking chocolate in the gas tank. So you're being deceptive there, if that's true. The physicists have developed a new incandescent light bulb suitable for residential use that is almost 100 times as energy efficient as existing bulbs. That seems totally plausible. New fossil analysis shows that the so-called hobbit, poor little Bilbo, or Homo bilbous, had long flat feet more like apes than humans and therefore could not walk efficiently. Wow, that's weird. I mean, I can't really picture... Well, actually, I could picture that. I mean, walk efficiently, you had a different way of walking, maybe, you know, wasn't really evolved to the point where it could do that in an efficient manner. But yeah, that makes sense. Wow, I'm all right. I'm gonna go with the light bulb.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, the biofuel from chocolate. I think we're meant to just be so freaked about that to just jump on that one.
What are you saying?
Yeah, but of course I could be
I'm
wrong.
A reactionary? Is that what you're saying?
No, it seems too obvious. And again, he could be expecting that. But yeah, Jay, I agree with you that it doesn't necessarily. He's not going to be throwing chocolate into this thing. If it's true, it'll probably be, you know, maybe not the chocolate plant, but maybe the cocoa bean plant.
Yeah, the derivative of that, sure.
Chocolate plant.
Chocolate.
So I guess that's possible, but bizarre. The second one, I could see that 100 times as energy efficient. That's a lot. 100 times is pretty significant if it's true. And the Hobbit one, that one, it makes sense. That one makes sense to me as well. So I mean, I could justify any of these. So it's hard to figure out to suss it out. So I'm just gonna have to flip a coin and just go with my instinct that that we're meant to go for the chocolate one because it's just so bizarre
and delicious.
And the light bulb one, I suspect is a mutated news item from another similar news item. So I'm going to say that's fiction.
All right. So you all agree that a new fossil analysis shows that the so-called Hobbit, or Homo floresiensis, had long flat feet more like apes than humans and therefore could not walk efficiently. You all agree that that one is science.
Mm-hmm.
And that one is indeed science.
Aha.
Science.
So what was the deal, Steve? They couldn't quite walk well. Did they walk like actual the hobbits like we see in the movies?
Well, they were about as tall as a hobbit, and they did have these sort of long, flat feet. I guess they're kind of, although a hobbit had wide feet, right?
Wider is better.
Their feet were not as adapted to walking as modern humans. You know, we have arches to our feet so that they give more support and spring, and they enable you to walk long distance more efficiently.
Tricksy, my precious.
Yes, very tricksy.
Four hobbits.
This is interesting. So this is on an Indonesian island of Flores. They've been finding fossils of these short-statured hominids, and the debate has been, were these first specimens that were found Homo sapiens, humans, that either were just extremely short, maybe perhaps an example of island dwarfism, or maybe even there was some genetic disorder that made them have the features that were being observed, particularly the overall short stature. And they were there from 90,000 to about 18,000 years ago. So 18,000 years ago, that would mean that would be the most recently surviving hominid species other than Homo sapiens, if true. The next most recent one would be Neanderthal man, which died out about 35,000 years ago. Which means we could have, you know, just barely missed having a second human-like species on the planet by just 18,000 years, if true. And since the first specimens were found, they've been finding more and more and more specimens. So it's clearly not just one or two individuals with some genetic disorder. It's a population of 3-foot-tall people with the same features. So it looks like it's, you know, the evidence seems to be going into the direction that this is another species.
That's cool.
And this is the latest bit of evidence pushing in that direction. They examined the bones of the feet, and they look more, they resemble more the feet of chimpanzees than they do the feet of modern humans. They were not really fully adapted to long-range walking like the modern human foot is. Mm. Which means that this species may have branched off, pretty far back. They may have branched off even from like Australopithecines.
Whoa.
You know?
Oh, that's ridiculous.
1.7 million years ago?
Or more. I mean, the question is, what was the common ancestor between humans, you know, Homo sapiens, and Homo floresiensis? How far back in time is that common ancestor? This evidence would suggest that it may be pretty far back. Maybe it's Homo erectus. Homo erectus is the species that essentially spread out from Africa throughout the rest of the world. They were, you know, as tall as modern humans, pretty much.
And then we kicked their butts.
They definitely used fire. They evolved into Neanderthal man, which probably in Africa, which had, you know, then migrated throughout Europe, and then later evolved into Homo sapiens, again, probably in Africa, and then we took over the world, right?
End of story.
So maybe this was another side branch off of Homo erectus, or maybe they branched off even earlier than that, like the Australopithecines. You may be going back 3-4 million years. Very interesting. This is unbelievable.
Steve, now, if I remember, it was quite a controversy whether these were a distinct line or just funny-looking normal humans. Does this really put that debate to bed?
I don't think it's quite to bed yet.
But it's getting pretty tired, and it's under the covers.
It's moving in that direction, and this moves it further in that direction. So they've found enough specimens now that it's not just one diseased or mutant individual, right?
Oh yeah, it's yeah.
So that's been put to bed. Very cool, very cool. This is a story I've been watching for a couple of years now. And again, I always get very interested when new data comes out.
It's funny, they're focusing on the head and the brain case, and at the other end of the skeleton with some good evidence
that
they could.
Oh yeah, yep. So let's see what's next. Scientists reveal the first car that can run on biofuel made from chocolate. Evan, you think this one is the fiction. Bob and Jay think this one is science.
Somehow.
And this one is science.
Science!
Yeah! Awesome.
Now, the headline reads, "Scientists unveil chocolate-fueled race car." But, you know, if I went with that, I think that would be a little deceptive. You aren't putting chocolate directly into the gas tank. It is biofuel made from chocolate waste, right? So it's actually not directly from the plant itself. It's the waste made from in the process of making chocolate.
Yeah, you mean like the leftover biomass?
Yeah.
The biomass.
Vegetable oils
sure.
and stuff, yeah.
Okay.
The biofuels made from... You know, that's the key phrase there. I mean, you know, you can make biofuels from so many different things. As long as you have some molecule that has energy in it, you might potentially make a biofuel from it.
Yeah, but why chocolate, though?
Well, I don't know. I guess any manufacturing process that has a lot of waste oils or something that has energy in it, that's a good candidate, right?
And that just goes to show how much chocolate's being made around the world.
Right.
It's a lot of chocolate.
How about sugar cane?
It could be viable.
Then?
Sugarcane is probably the best biofuel crop right now. Very high energy, yep. So I don't know if this is actually going to come to any kind of industrial use or fruition. This is just one car, a concept car. But they say it can go 145 miles per hour.
Wow. It's called the Wonka.
That's pretty fast.
It's called the Wonka Mobile.
Yeah, for Wonka Mobile, that's right. The Wonka Mobile.
Take my car for a ride, and you'll feel that real acceleration.
Wow, Evan.
Wow.
Evan, I got to take you out drinking, man.
Why? So I'll sing more?
Oh, God, help him.
All right, which means
that we,
physicists,
right.
have developed a new incandescent light bulb suitable for residential use that is almost 100 times as efficient, energy efficient as existing bulbs, is complete fiction.
Yes. Complete fiction.
Like totally fiction? You made the whole thing up.
Well, I was inspired by a real news item, as typical. Physicists have created a new kind of incandescent light bulb, but not one that's 100 times as energy efficient as the regular bulb, and not one that's suitable for residential use.
Was it that nano bulb?
Yes, the nano one. They've made one. This is the smallest incandescent light bulb ever made.
How big is it?
Made from a single carbon nanotube, only 100 atoms wide.
You couldn't see it unless it was lit. You couldn't see it.
Right. And this would only obviously not be useful to light your home, right? This is maybe would have research applications.
You know, but Steve, those nanobulbs could be used someday to make a cool monitor.
Maybe.
Or to look inside little nano closets.
Maybe.
This is the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Who's that noisy?
Evan, play for us once again. Who's that noisy?
Who's that noisy?
From last week.
And here it is.
Call of day ומתנדבי מדה. מגן דוד אדום, אתם עושים עבודה משגעת, הלוואי ולא היינו בזמנים כאלה, אבל זהו, רציתי להגיד לכולם, עוד פעם, לכל עובדי מגן דוד אדום בכל הארץ, המון אהבה, ולסיום אני עומד לעשות משהו מצחיק עכשיו.
אוקיי, חברים, שימו לב.
And who was that, Evan?
Yeah, a lot of people did get that, and that was our good old friend, Uri Geller. Oh, yes, Uri Geller. How about Uri Geller?
Uri Geller.
Whatever.
Geller. I still think him pounding on the table is such a good dramatic effect.
Well, that was almost a clue. And then you kind of hear some silverware kind of bouncing around.
Yeah.
The table's moving.
So, that guy's a one-trick pony.
But we had people writing in saying, you know, they speak Hebrew and so forth or whatever. And,
I guess that would help.
They recognized
him. And what was,
Steve,
what was he saying?
You recognized
him. I recognized his voice even though I had no idea what he was saying because I don't
speak Hebrew.
That's
pretty impressive, Steve. Evan, what was he saying during that clip? This is Uri Geller and I bend spoons.
Yeah. He was saying, I'm a fraud. I'm a charlatan. I am a scam artist. I do not come from another planet, or I'm not controlled by a giant spaceship that hovers above the Earth. I do not derive my psychic powers from that. I merely trick people with the oldest tricks in the book.
That's a loose translation, but yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, I might have thrown in a few, you know.
Hebrew, to me, sounds incredibly passionate whenever I hear people speaking it. They just sound totally impassioned, you know?
Mm-hmm. And how often do you hear people speaking Hebrew?
I've heard it many, many times.
Last time I heard Hebrew, I think, was when I joined you for the Seder 1 year, Evan.
Yeah, that's right. I had a few friends over for Seder.
Did you guys know that Spock or Leonard Nimoy came up with the Vulcan hand gesture from a Jewish tradition?
Yeah, what nerd doesn't know that?
I think they did an In Search Of episode on that.
In Search Of the hand gesture.
That was good science. Now that was science.
In Search Of.
Oh, man. Leonard.
I used to eat those shows up, and then, you know, when I was like very little. But,
when you were eight?
I saw an episode a couple years ago. Oh, my, are they terrible.
Oh, yeah right?
Oh, it's just.
Oh, God. They didn't hold up well, right?
It's like the Nimoy singing about the Hobbit or whatever.
Yes. That it's like whacking you over the head with a dumb stick watching that show.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man. Indians call him Sasquatch. They believe he is as gentle as he is powerful and mysterious.
But you know, I still love listening to his voice.
I was thinking the same thing,
yeah,
Steve.
That deep baritone kind of voice.
Listen, guys.
Man, that is so 1970s.
Just a little. Jeez. Did the Leisure Suit come with that recording?
I really think I watched every single episode.
Maybe. More than once.
Oh
yeah.
Thank goodness I was too young to really catch on. I knew of it.
Oh, Spock, how could you let us down that way?
He didn't know. We still love you, Spock.
I think he was conned.
Conned! I was conned!
Evan, play this week's Who's That Noisy.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We have one this week. All right. This week's Who's That Noisy. Here it comes.
Jay, please read us a quote, a very skeptical, witty, pithy quote, if you will.
I sure will, Steve. This one is from Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson said, "Question with boldness even the existence of God, because, if there be one, he must more approve of the homage of reason than that of blindfolded fear." Thomas J. Jefferson!
TJ to his friends.
See how I snuck the J-ref in there? I guess not.
Yeah, that was pretty lame.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for joining me again this week, guys.
Absolutely. It's our job, Steve.
Yes, surely. It is.
This is what
tirelessly.
We do.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkepChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.